Once more, St. Luke's, I'm honored to introduce our guest preacher of the day, Bishop John Hopkins. John is no stranger to Indiana. He and his wife, Elaine, served a number of ministry assignments throughout the former South Indiana Conference, including Methodist Temple in Evansville. John was elected as a bishop in 1996 and served two different assignments as bishop of the Minnesota Annual Conference and then the Ohio East Annual Conference before retirement in 2016. Now in retirement, John and Elaine enjoy traveling and being active in their many places of involvement in St. Luke's and being grandparents, which I totally get and understand. John, thank you for preaching today. St. Luke's, please welcome as our preacher this morning, Bishop John Hopkins.
Thank you, Rob. You know, he's kind of like God. You know, wherever you go, he pipes in and you think he's right here. I do thank you, Rob, for sharing that. But one of the things Rob didn't tell you is that after it was announced that he's going to retire a year from now, the next sermon that he preached was over the top. It was so good that at the end of the service, I came out and said, Rob, if you want to help your successor towards the end of your term, you've got to start preaching some bad sermons. And then within 2 weeks, he called and asked if I wanted to preach here. Thank you very much, Rob. I appreciate that. Actually, Elaine and I have been here for 10 years, and this is kind of like family to us, but the reason I agreed to preach today is very interesting. It's because of two saintly women in this congregation, Kathy Clemens and Diane Motto. They asked me when I was going to preach here about 3 or 4 years ago, and I said, why? And they said, because we want you to tell the story that you told at the North Central Jurisdictional Quadrennial Meeting of the United Methodist Women, now United Women of Faith. And I said, really? You remember something? I said, when was that? So I went back and researched. It was March the 8th of 2008. If I told a story 18 years ago that somebody remembers, then I felt God wanted me to preach here today, and that's why I'm back. It's also interesting that 2 months after I told that story, the General Conference met. And that was the General Conference that they added witness to the membership vows. So now it's prayers, presence, gifts, and service, and then they added witness. And that's what I want to talk about this morning. Elaine and I have been active here at St. Luke's over 10 years now, and I feel like I'm speaking to family. And this might sound strange, but it's harder to speak to family than it is to large audiences around the world that you don't really know. I'm really a member of the Council of Bishops, but I feel like I belong to you. So bear with me as I share a message with you. Let us pray. Lord, may the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable to you, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. Amen. Here we are in the middle of Matthew chapter 19. Jesus has been teaching, healing, calming storms. He's been walking on water even. And here in the middle of Matthew, those closest to him don't seem to know who he is. Listen to the scripture here. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do the people say they am? They said, well, some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, others say Jeremiah or one of the prophets. And Jesus turns to those closest to him who've been following him, and he says, but who do you say that I am? And who do you say that I am? And Simon Peter, who was kind of impetuous, he said, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Jesus in Matthew needs a witness. It's the middle of his gospel where he's preaching the gospel and talking about what God wants for us. And people still don't get it. So he realizes that in the future, he's going to have a death and resurrection. And who's going to carry on the message after he's gone? So he builds the church and gives a blueprint to the disciples of how they're to carry on after he's no longer there. And the first blueprint, there's three blueprint things I want to talk about. The first thing is that the church is built every time somebody recognizes who Jesus Christ is. Have you ever thought about that? Jesus built the church not with bricks and water, but he did it with people recognizing him. And once you recognize who Jesus is, then everything else kind of follows. But we forget. We forget, and our witness pales. One of the things that those of you that know me already know that I like to do, I like to ask questions about how did you get to St. Luke's? I'm not really interested in how you got to St. Luke's. I want to know the story of your life before you arrived here. And if I had an opportunity, rather than preaching a sermon, I really mean this. I'd like to buy you a cup of coffee or tea and spend 30 minutes to an hour just finding out how God has worked in your life in ways that you recognized it and in ways that you did not recognize how God worked in your life. And so I don't have time to talk to all of you and hear your story this morning. I want to tell you my story. My story is really not particularly unique, but if I tell my story, it might open you up a little bit to at least identify where God has come close to you and maybe where you didn't notice that God was close to you. My father was born in Birmingham, Alabama. He quit school in the eighth grade. He moved to Montgomery and met my mother, got married, went to World War II, came back, and I was born about 9 months and 2 weeks after he returned. You get the message. December 1, 1955, does that ring a bell? That was my 10th birthday, a famous day in world history. December 1, 1955. I'll do the math for you. I'm 80 years old. I know you're working on the math. That was a famous day in world history because on that day, Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. That was my 10th birthday. On that day, my father, who had come back from World War II with an eighth grade education, didn't know how to use the GI Bill, which was a blessing to this country. He didn't know what to do, so he got a job putting water and gas in buses. And then 10 years later, on my birthday, when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat, my father was the superintendent of maintenance at that bus company. He was in charge of all of the buses and all of the mechanics. I've never shared this before in any public situation, but my sister found something that she passed on to me, and here it is. This is my father's mechanics jumpsuit. On the back of it, Montgomery City Lines, 1955. What is that, 71 years ago? I was born in a segregated South, where some people would say we were politically divided, but I would say we were morally divided. And as I look at this, I remember separate drinking fountains where the one that was refrigerated and clean was for white people and the one that was never refrigerated and never clean was for black people. I remember separate restrooms where there was one for men and women and then another one that was just for colored, and sometimes it was an outhouse out back. I remember separate school systems. This is not the first time that our country has been divided morally. And when I look at this, especially the front of it, this has been balled up in some bag for years. From 1955 or earlier, there's sweat, there's grease, and there's grit and grime on here that when I think about it, I remember the past and give thanks. It was out of this upbringing that I kind of recognized who Jesus was. Let me tell you the rest of the story. My mom and dad wanted to move out of Montgomery almost immediately. The boycott, by the way, I wish I could preach a sermon on it. It was wonderful. The solidarity of the African Americans and supporters actually was a great model for how people come together to change things. But my family wanted to get out of town as soon as possible. So that was December. In September, my family moved to Houston and I started the fifth grade. I love the fifth grade. In fact, I had my first girlfriend in the fifth grade. Only problem is she didn't know I was her girl. She was my girlfriend. And if you think about it, that's how it worked back then, right? Everything was going well until about the fall of my sixth grade year. I don't remember exact date. It seems like it was getting close to Advent. My father walked in one day with tears in his eyes in the middle of the day, and I said, oh, what's going on? It was the end of my childhood. He said he had lost his job. My mom was a homemaker, and they didn't know what they were going to do. How were they going to support the family? My mom later said we had as much of a normal Christmas as possible. How do you have a normal Christmas when there's no income in the family? And so right after Christmas, he had one of those family meetings, and they asked me, say, John, we don't know what to do while we look for a job. You got your two-year-old sister and your older brother staying with a family in Montgomery. We would like you to move to Atlanta and stay with an aunt and uncle and two cousins. What do you do when your mom and dad ask you to move out of the house so that the family can survive and you don't want to move? Well, you suck it up and you go. So I moved from Houston, Texas to Atlanta, Georgia. Actually, it was Decatur, Avondale Estates, if you really know that area. And I moved in with a wonderful aunt and uncle and two cousins about my age. They were wonderful, but I was lonely and it was a hard time. Back then, time moved very slow in the sixth grade. It took forever for Friday to come. And some of you are old enough to remember that phone calls were expensive, a three-minute call, and letters were few. So I'd have a phone call with my family about every 2 weeks and a letter about every 2 weeks, and I would hold on to those things. The good news is, though, staying with that family, there was kind of a rule. If you ate at their table, you went to church on Sunday morning and Sunday evening. Any of you remember the wonderful Sunday evening services? Oh, thank you for saying that. They were marvelous. And I can't, this is hard for me to talk about because I can't find words to express it. But I was at the end of my emotional rope at one of those evening services, and I was thinking about what had happened earlier. I'd received a box of Easter presents before Easter. And my aunt was so excited that we received those gifts. And I remember crying myself to sleep that night because if I got gifts, that means my mom and dad were not going to be joining me for Easter. And that's what my prayers were. And so one of those nights when I was in that church service, I was about two-thirds of the way back. I guess it would be back in this area. And I was away from family. When you're in the sixth grade, you really don't want to be too close to family. And I didn't see anything. I didn't hear anything. But what it felt like is that Jesus walked down the center aisle and slid over to the pew next to me, put his hand around my arm and said, John, you're going to be all right. You're going to be all right. And all of a sudden, I kind of relaxed, and I felt empowered, like somehow something had happened to me. I know this sounds spiritual, but this is a church. And somehow I knew I was going to be all right. Now the interesting thing is, my dad still didn't have a job. I was still lonely. I didn't know when my family was going to be back together, but I knew I was going to be all right. I knew I was going to be right because somehow God came to me. I didn't go to God. It wasn't anything I did. I just felt this sense of presence. You see, in the South, there was a concept of trouble. Boy, that family's got trouble. Whew, she's really got trouble. Well, if you can fix it yourself, you don't have trouble. And there's sometimes God comes to us when we can't fix something ourselves, or we can't fix the society we live in, that we have a peace that we can carry on and do what we need to do and empowers us. Well, after that happened, my father finally got a job in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And after that long sixth grade, I joined the family, and it was a difficult transition. I had grown up, my childhood had ended, and so it was difficult moving back in. During the summer, one of the neighborhood kids invited me to join the Boy Scouts. The Boy Scouts taught me to pick the lock to the church gym so we could play so that we could play basketball before the scout meetings. And then wasn't long the scouts, this is kind of like Rob's story, really. The scouts invited me to go to MYF that met in the same gym. And then within weeks, they said, well, our 7th and 8th grade Sunday school class meets on Sunday morning. So I went from the scouts to the youth group, to the 7th and 8th grade Sunday school class, And that became the confirmation class. And I was baptized and joined the church when I was 13. I may not have done that had this didn't happen. It's interesting of how one thing leads to another. And so when I was baptized, I was old enough to know what was going on. And I said, I really die to self and I'm raised in Christ. And I could not forget that experience in that church. And almost every few days, I still remember that because we live by the stories we tell ourselves. And if we can tell ourselves how God has come close to us, even if we can't understand it and can't find the words, then God can access us when we have need in our life. And who doesn't have some needs in their life? I went through the 9th grade in high school in Fort Wayne, Indiana, or Fort Wayne Central. And at the end of the 9th grade, I was flying high. I think I was dedicated to work hard, and I must have been gifted or something, because at the end of my freshman year, I had just finished a year of being the starting quarterback on the football team. I had one of the leads in the freshman class play. Elaine, my wife, had another lead in the freshman class play. And I was on the Honor Society, and most importantly, I was dating the future homecoming queen. And that wasn't Elaine. And then I was invited to go to a place called Epworth Forest. Some of you have been there. For Senior High Institute. And at Senior High Institute, it's a wonderful experience, and they have often activities and teaching and fun. And after this time, they also have a commitment night, Thursday night. And there's a time of silence, you know, you've probably been there. I hope you've had some experience like that. And the preacher there that evening invited us to come down if we were willing to follow Jesus the rest of our life. Well, for me, that was easy. But I was so blessed by how God had worked in me since I joined my family, and especially since my freshman year of high school. I remember walking down the aisle with a lump in my throat and tears in my eye to say, yes, I will. Not because I was broken, but because I was blessed. Jesus called me when I was broken and lonely, and Jesus called me when I was blessed and was so thankful. Many people only find Jesus and seek Jesus when they're in trouble. But I think Jesus finds us, because the experience of recognizing who Jesus is more about what Jesus does that we notice than about our own effort. And if I had to have some time with you, you might pass over spiritual things. I'd say, time out. You told me something in your life. Tell me more about it. Tell me more. What was your self-talk at that time? And one of the reasons we have a hard time witnessing to how God works in our life is that we let things slip away that I think are spiritual, because we can't put words to it, or we're embarrassed. The first thing Jesus teaches us is the church is built every time we recognize who Jesus is. The next lesson is, and Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it." Now, if Pastor Jen calls you, she's not going to say, here's what I'm going to do on you. She's going to ask you to do something to build the church. I'm surprised, if you read this carefully, Peter's not supposed to build the church. Jesus is going to do the building. So the second lesson is, the church is built when we let Jesus build the church. I served in Minnesota, East Ohio, and Chicago. When I was in Minnesota, East Ohio, I had about 760 churches. And at any given time, about 20 of them had some deep theological argument about what the color of the carpet ought to be, or whether the piano belongs on this side of the chancel or that side of the chancel. I used to think those arguments, because it's just human nature, we're ugly, it's our lowest part of our nature. But I said, oh no, it's just the opposite. I learned later, it's our highest nature. When you do anything for the church, you want it to be at the highest that you can imagine. And then you're on a committee meeting and somebody does the same thing and they don't necessarily agree, and we have conflicts, not because of our low nature. It's because we want the best that we can imagine. It's about we, about us. Dietrich Bonhoeffer and his life together has got this wonderful discussion about those who love their dream of Christian community more than real Christian community actually destroy the community that they're a part of. Now, this is a big church. When you walk in here, you're so glad it's got great lights, beautiful restrooms, nice carpet. But if you were in a small church, you'd walk in and say, who changed this carpet without talking to me? Some of you have been in those churches. One of the joys is a big church. You don't know who does it, but it's nice. I'm not sure that builds discipleship. So I mean, we all need to have a little, sweat equity in whatever we do here in the church. But let me keep this simple on this issue. Elaine and I have three sons. They're grown now after all of our work. When we worked with them when they were little, we did everything we could to perfect them because we knew more than God what they needed. We taught them how to speak, what to say, what not to say, how to open doors for people, how to dress, how not to dress. Now we have seven grandchildren. We don't try to fix them at all. We just love on them and we watch them grow. In fact, I tell young parents, those of you that are in the young parenting age, at some point you have to stop engineering your children and go to farming. You have to step back, put a little manure around, say, okay, I've done my side. God, you do the rest of it. And so that's it as a church. If you don't try to perfect the church, but try to love it like it's a grandchild, you will have a front row seat to miracles, and they happen right here at St. Luke's, and they happen out in the community because of the works that St. Luke does. The third lesson Jesus teaches me is that I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Then he sternly ordered his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. This is the New Revised Standard. It says, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth, what does that mean? Jesus needs a witness. It happens when people recognize who Jesus is. It happens when we let Jesus do the building. I think it means that the church is built when we live on earth like we want heaven to be. We live on earth like we want heaven to be. I mean, we often say, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as is in heaven. It's like when Jesus came, it's not like heaven's a place far away. Heaven is here. Jesus brought God here. I think Rob said, our job is to get heaven into people. It's not get people into heaven. You heard him say that. And so the church is built when we live on earth like we want heaven to be. And I could preach four sermons on this that would deal with different things. But what I really want to hone in on is that there are a lot of people who are living today that haven't experienced very much heaven, especially in our morally divided country. And they need hope and they need faith. And at St. Luke's, hope is your superpower. I mean, your statement says, what does it say? We helping people find and give hope through Jesus. You know, I got one story I have to tell you. When I was in Minnesota, Eric Huckey was the pastor at Bemidji. Isn't that a great name for a town? That's where Paul Bunyan is. And Eric Huckey, I preached up there once, and Eric Huckey said, I'm sorry that Harry's not going to be here today, Bishop, because he would love to meet you and you'd love to meet him. I said, why? He said, Harry is a hopeful person. He's in his 90s now, I think 96. And he said, everybody, he was the grand marshal of the parade this year in Bemidji, but he's not here. He's got some other commitment, but he wanted to know. I said, well, tell me more about his hope. He said, well, Harry's the kind of person, when he was 94 years old, bought a new Ford truck. And then he bought the extended warranty. That is St. Luke's. You never give up on people. And I don't have time to go through all the things you do here, but let's just take the Freedom School. Last week when those kids sang, they sang a song about identity. And I said to myself, if they can know who they are, then the world can throw anything at them and they're going to be fine. Well, same with you, right? If you know your identity, who you are with God, then anything can come at you, and you've got a supportive community that'll give you hope, and you've got an internal ballast that'll keep your ship upright. What I want to know about Freedom School is all those people who work to put it on, like Mr. Lang. You know, I want to hear their story about what happened in their life that said, we can help somebody else do this. We can make the world better by living on earth like we want heaven to be. There's a story behind everything St. Luke's does that's wrapped up in your identity and the people who volunteer. So I want to tell you just one story and then close. This is a story that Joe Walker, when he worked for the Board of Stewardship in Nashville, told me, and I've told it several times. And I asked him once, am I telling it about right? And he said, it's about right. Joe had a two-point charge in Kentucky, and one of his churches was out in a holler, they call it. You had to drive back into it, and it was a two-room church. How many of you have ever seen a two-room church? I've seen a lot of them. There's one room where they do worship, and then there's a room in the back where they do everything else, from a clothes rack to teaching the children to having church suppers. And one of those churches, that's all they had. They didn't even have any indoor plumbing. They had an outhouse in the back, and they had a pump out back. And so our pastor friend, when he just first got there, the trustees had already decided that they were going to work on that church and make it better. Well, in that church, there was a woman named Annie. She was probably 87, 88, 89. Nobody knew it. Annie lived out about 2.5 miles from the church. Today, we would say that she's mentally challenged. They used other names to describe her back then. But Annie would walk that 2.5 miles to church every Sunday and go back. In worship, she couldn't read or write very well, and you could hear her sometimes, but her communication wasn't that good. But because she couldn't read and write, she still could sing the songs because she had come to church so much, she had memorized most of the words and the tunes. So she would participate, and then she would visit a little bit and walk back home. Well, while her pastor friend just arrived, he thought it was a good idea to improve the church, and the trustee said, well, we don't have much money. We collected some money last month, but we can hook up that pump outside to electric motor. They had electricity had come in about 6 years before with lights. And he said, I think we can put running water in. He said, we actually wanted to put a hot water heater. We didn't have the money for that, but we're going to hook it up. Within 6 or 7, 9 months, we'll add a hot water heater. And we're also going to put in a new sink back in that back room when we have these carry-in dinners. The pastor said, fine. So that next Saturday, the trustees were working in the church, putting in that plumbing in the back room. And the pastor said, I better stop in. So he walked in the sanctuary and he walked in the back room. You know, pastors always walk in to see where the work's going, and then they walk out because they're doing something else important. He walked in the sanctuary, and when he walked into the back room, he looked at the plumbing, looked over, and there was a water heater sitting in the corner. He said, well, where did that come from? He said, we didn't have any. We were going to do this 6 or 9 months. And the head of the trustee said, well, Annie said we could have hers, and she gave it to us. He said, Annie said that? Well, the next day when they had, that was Saturday, on Sunday, they had finished their work. And so in the service, they had a carry-in dinner, and they were celebrating all the work. And in the announcements, the pastor looked down at Annie, and he said, Annie, I want to thank you for the gift of that, but you shouldn't have done that. You didn't need to do that, but we really appreciate that. When he said that, Annie looked at her feet kind of like she was a little embarrassed. After the service was over, you know how it is, everybody was moving around, moving food. The pastor asked for Annie, and somebody said, you know, I think she went on home. He was thinking, oh no, I hope I didn't embarrass her. I'm hoping that she really gave it and knew what she was doing when she gave the hot water heater. So as soon as they ate and all the festivities were over, the pastor, who had never been there before, drove to Annie's house, drove the 2.5 hours, pulled up his car, and found out that Annie lived in a two-room house. You ever seen a two-room house? It was in the south. There was a porch and a screen door, of course, and then there was a small living area in the front. And then as you walked into the back area, there's a pot-bellied stove. On one side, there was a kitchenette. On the other side, there was a bed. The pastor hit the front porch and said, Annie, are you there? She said, yes, I thought you might be coming. Come on in. So he walked into the living room, walked back with a pot-belly stove and looked over on the right and saw the pipes disconnected where Annie had given her own water heater to the church. He said, Annie, you shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have done that. She said, sit down, Pastor. I want to talk to you. You want some coffee? He said, yeah, I could use some. She poured him a cup of coffee. She stopped, sat down beside him, and they looked at each other. She said, Pastor, you don't know this, but I was born in this room. My mama was not married, and you know, I can't talk very clearly. My brain doesn't work well. So I grew up with people making fun of me, but it never bothered me because my mom told me that on the day I was born, she was so thankful that I'd come into this world. And she says it got night. She hugged me to her breast to thank God that I was in this world. And she said, my mom said, she looked out this window right here and she looked up into the sky. And my mom told me that there was a new star in the sky just for me. Then it got real quiet. And she said, my mom told me that she could hear a choir of angels' voices singing a hymn just for me. And if I have my own star in the sky, and I have a choir of angel voices singing a song for me, what the heck do I need with a hot water heater? That's the way it starts, isn't it? It starts when you and I realize on the day we were born, there was a star in the sky for us and a choir of heavenly angels singing for us. And when that happens, then we know that everybody that we see, whether they're Russian, Iranian, Somalian, Haitian, I could go on, but the day they were born too, there was a star in the sky and a choir of angels singing for them. And when we recognize that, then everything else that comes to us, we can handle individually and as a wonderful church like this. Can you tell your story? Can you tell the story of how you recognize Jesus? Can you let Jesus do the building? And can you help live on earth like you want heaven to be? I asked the worship team, I said, I can't be the only one. Can you find a couple of cardboard testimonies? And we got a few people from St. Luke's who did that.